right. We have two cases on our 9 o'clock docket. We'll go through both of those, and then we'll take a short recess until our 10:30 docket, for which we have also a panel change. Ms. Bizak, if you'll announce counsel for the first case.
May I please the court?
All right, Mr. Tatum.
Your Honor, may it please the court. Thomas's argument on the sole point before this court today, I think, is a classic example of two ways of looking at the same issue. In other words, I think we're dealing with a result orientation type argument, which I'll explain shortly. Briefly, Mr. Thomas left work on July 12, 2001. He received 12 weeks of FMLA leave, that's the Family Medical Leave Act. He was released to return to work in April of 2002, but he could not pass a physical test that was required of all persons in his job category. The record is silent about what happened from April until August 1st, 2002, when his employment was terminated pursuant to a no-fault provision in his collective bargaining agreement, which provided that a one-year absence would result in termination. After the termination, through his union, Mr. Thomas engaged in the grievance procedure that was set forth in the CBA, which was a three-step process, each step of which resulted in an adverse finding to Mr. Thomas, and this suit then followed, despite the fact that the CBA called for a different process, specifically arbitration. Mr. Thomas was aware of that requirement in the CBA. He testified in a deposition, and that's in the record before this court, which was the CBA called for arbitration to be the next step in the process, or the grievance was to be considered settled. The union did not move forward on Mr. Thomas's behalf with an arbitration, and Mr. Thomas did not do so himself, and this suit followed. The parties ultimately filed summary judgments, and the court granted Thomas's summary judgment on one ground, specifically his breach of contract claim. In that claim, he contends that the CBA, the collective bargaining agreement, and the one-year provision provided in the collective bargaining agreement should include or should take into account FMLA leave, which was contained in a different document, the operations handbook that the T provided to its employees, setting forth policies and procedures, including an absence control policy. The operations handbook, in its absence control policy, excludes from the definition of absence such things as holidays, jury duty, vacations, FMLA leave, and military service.
Why would the T give employees a handbook that has inconsistent provisions from the collective bargaining agreement? Because it does appear that excluding FMLA leave from the meaning of the term absence in the book is different from what this collective bargaining agreement provides.
Well, first of all, I think the two documents deal with two different situations, and I think that's the explanation. The absence control policy is intended to make sure that employees return or show up at work every day, and it provides for a graduated system of disciplinary procedures in case that policy is violated. The absence control policy and all of the exceptions to the definition of absence that are contained in that policy contemplate being out of work for less than 1 year. Essentially, all of them except for medical leave are less, in 99.9% of the cases, would result in an absence of, or in a lack of being at work, I should say, for a week, 10 days, 2 weeks, up to the 12-week period that the FMLA provides for. So I think the absence control policy in the handbook is meant to deal with short absences, absences that are authorized by the employer, such as holidays and vacation time, which are mentioned in there. The CBA provision the no-fault absent or the no-fault provision in the CBA, which is what it's called, is intended to deal with a situation like this one, where the employee was off work for one 12-month period. In that situation, this was the result of a collective bargaining process between the union and the employer. The only excuse from being off work for 12 straight months is military leave. That is a bargain for provision, and I think the distinction between these two deal with two different things. The absence control policy deals with shorter absences, chronic absenteeism, things such as that involve a day here, a week there, and situations like that, where the no-fault policy deals with one situation only, and that's the absence from work for one whole year. The court below granted summary judgment in favor of Mr. Thomas on one issue, and that was his breach of contract claim, in which he contended that the CBA was breached, his collective bargaining agreement was breached, because his termination for being absent for 1 year, actually it was a month or two longer than 12 months, was a breach of the agreement because the agreement included the FMLA leave that was provided for in the operations handbook. That's the sole issue before the court today. Thomas contends the two provisions must be read together and that he is entitled to return to work because at least part of his absence was covered by FMLA leave. That argument fails, I think, for several reasons. First, the handbook has in multiple places in it clear language that it is a disclaimer. It and the CBA cannot be read together. There is no intention, and this is an almost direct quote, that anything in the employee handbook be regarded as contractual or that it be regarded in connection with the CBA. The contention that the two documents must be read together in this situation, I submit, is result-oriented reasoning. If the handbook...
Aren't you saying that he should have gone to arbitration?
Well, that's another reason why this matter should be reversed. Yes, he waived his remedy under the CBA because he failed to go to arbitration.
All right. If he wasn't required to go to arbitration, what does that do to your position?
Well, what it does, it doesn't affect the position with regard to the breach of contract claim and the impropriety or error in granting summary judgment on that claim because, again, the two documents have to be read together in order to grant the summary judgment. In order for there to be a breach of contract, there has to be a ruling that the CBA required FMLA leave to be included in or counted in the absence. The CBA says no such thing. The only thing the CBA provides for is military
service. So
you're
arguing that he was required to participate in arbitration and failed to do so is just sort of a fail-safe position or a backup position?
Well, no. The position that he was required to follow arbitration, I think, is not a fail-safe position. I think it basically requires that the summary judgment be reversed and that we be permitted to go to trial because he waived his right to claim that the CBA was breached. He waived any right, quite frankly, to proceed with this lawsuit. But we are here on a summary judgment that was granted on a breach of contract claim.
Contract.
So our position very strongly urges this court to consider that all of these arguments that Mr. Thomas has made in response to this appeal have been waived because he failed to follow the contract procedures provided for. The second reason, anyway, I was going to say the first reason why the reasoning that the two documents should be read together fails is because of the disclaimers. It's very clear that there was no contractual meaning to the language in the handbook in terms of the CBA. For the second reason, and I think I've alluded to this or gone into this in response to one of the court's questions, is that none of the items listed in the handbook constitute absences that are of a nature that would have resulted in a one-year absence from work. Therefore, they're two entirely different issues. They deal with different things and cannot be read together or in essence can be read together consistently because they deal with two different issues. Finally, as the court just pointed out, and probably decisively, all of these issues were waived because the CBA calls for arbitration after the three-step process, grievance process, has been concluded. Either party can proceed to arbitration if either party, either the T or Mr. Thomas, was dissatisfied with the results of the grievance process.
But can't either party waive arbitration? And, of course, the appellee is suggesting that you all have waived arbitration.
Well, that is based on a fact issue, quite frankly, Your Honor, with regard to response time on one of the grievances, as I understand the argument.
Well, also litigation conduct inconsistent with arbitration.
That particular issue, neither one of those two issues, quite frankly, were raised at the court below. They were not presented as grounds for summary judgment. And I submit that they can't be considered at this point. But the arbitration language is sort of, self-operating, as it were. If a party doesn't ask for, submit the case to arbitration at the conclusion of the grievance process, that party is considered to have been satisfied with the result of the grievance process. There needs to be an affirmative act taken to indicate dissatisfaction with the grievance process and a desire to want to pursue further remedies through the arbitration process.
What about the fact, and I can't find it right now, but I'm thinking that the wording of the grievance process speaks in terms of what the employee is to do. The wording of the arbitration provision that follows speaks in terms of what either party is to do, which seems to refer to the parties to the collective bargaining agreement, which would be the union and the employer. And is it not up to the union whether to proceed to arbitration or not? And if it apparently, which it chose not to do in this case, doesn't do so, then where does that leave the employee?
Well, it leaves the employee with a claim against the union, perhaps. But under the terms of the CBA, the union, and I think the record doesn't indicate that Mr. Thomas made any significant demand on the union to proceed to arbitration. I think he made that request, and the union turned it down. But what that leaves him with is a claim against his union, but not a claim against the company.
And how do you reconcile your argument with Article 13, Section C, and Article 3, Section A? Article 3, Section A reserves the decision to lay off or hire and fire to management, and Article 13, Section C says issues arising out of the exercise of rights reserved to management under the title Rights of Management above, including management's determination of the facts underlying exercise of such rights, shall not be subject to arbitration.
Well, I think we have to read all of this in the context of the overall agreement, which governs the relationship between management and the employees. I submit at a minimum those two items are in conflict. The issue relating to management rights also was not raised in the court below, and I submit cannot be considered by this court in considering the summary judgment.
Did they raise an issue with regard to an inconsistent position by asserting the use of Article 12, which outlines the grievance procedure, as opposed to the arbitration procedure in 13?
No.
Okay.
I would point the court's, or direct the court's attention to Volume 3 of the clerk's record, pages 434, 435, and 436, which is the entire argument on the one count that the court granted summary judgment on, the court below. And in that, the entire argument relates to the claim that the language in the operating handbook should be read together with the no-fault provision to provide that FMLA leave should be counted, or should not be counted as an absence. No other issues were raised in the court below, and I don't believe this court can consider those. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tatum. Mr. Brender.
Please the court. I'm pleased to be here representing Mr. Thomas, who is seated over here to my right. Let me address first this question of what was raised in the court below, because I believe counsel is wrong about that. To do that, I'm going to just mention briefly this sort of tortured history in which this case had, because there was a motions for summary judgment on both sides filed in 2006. One of them was denied. The defendants, the plaintiffs, was taken under advisement, and then the defendants removed the case to federal court, where it was for almost a year before Judge Means then remanded it. When it came back, the plaintiffs amended their motion for summary judgment. The defendants amended theirs, and then responded about 2 days before the hearing in December of 07 with a defendant's response and objections to plaintiff's first amended motion for summary judgment. And at this point, they attached as evidence this waiver argument. This is where they're raising this. And they included the letter from the Fort Worth Transportation Authority, which is the step two portion of that. And they also added some affidavits and that sort of thing. The plaintiffs then responded initially orally and asked the court, and the court gave us permission to then reduce that to writing. And that's plaintiff's reply to defendant's response and objections to plaintiff's first amended motion for summary judgment. And these waiver arguments are all contained in that response. So they were raised before the trial court. They were argued before the trial court. And I think they're properly before it. They weren't part of the motion for summary judgment because they were defensive issues that were then raised. And like I said, instead of moving for continuance, we just argued them orally and then reduced it to writing later, and then the court made a decision after that. So that's the scenario in which those were presented, and I think properly presented. And the one that's clearest, quite frankly, I don't believe the arbitration procedure. Typically, a union contract has an arbitration procedure for work stoppages. They're very vague and usually voluntary on individual rights because, quite frankly, neither the unions nor the company want to take every grievance to arbitration. It's expensive, et cetera, et cetera. And so usually it is not mandatory. And in this case, I don't think it's even required, even though they did it. I've argued that not Article 13, and the court's familiar with it, basically reserves to management these rights to decide various obligations, qualifications, et cetera, of employment. And those are not even arbitratable. the other argument against this waiver argument is that, quite frankly, it goes back to my argument about to interpret this contract as the defendants want to interpret it, as the T wants to interpret it, would be violative of the Family Medical Leave Act. And in order to waive your rights under the Family Medical Leave Act, they have to be clear and concise that you're doing that. And there's a Supreme Court case that says that. There's no waiver provision whatsoever about that in there. In addition, they presented clear evidence that they waived their rights, and that is the Exhibit 22 to their defendant's response and objections to plaintiff's first admitted motion for summary judgment. I don't have the record site, but it's in the brief. And what they did was the letter's dated September the 4th. I don't think there's any fact issue to be decided because they said the company's done this, et cetera. The meeting was held on August 28th in my office. Goes through the whole thing. This is the letters from Nancy K. Amos, who is the senior vice president of the T, and it's addressed to the president of the Teamsters Union, and it says, you know, that we denied the grievance. Well, under the grievance procedure, they have to do that within 5 days of the grievance being presented. Well, by their own letter, it's after that. For the 28th of August, August has 31 days. That's 3 days. This is dated September the 4th. They didn't do it within their five-day period. They waived their rights under the grievance procedure. So the waiver argument is more slanted towards Mr. Thomas than it is towards them. But I would point out something about this whole waiver provision, because I've cited those Supreme Court decisions, which are very clear, and I think Justice Gardner maybe go to the point that you're raising, and that is because of the way these union contracts are written, the individual sometimes is left out in the cold. If the union is the sole decider on whether or not to take something to arbitration. Mr. Thomas said he did. In his deposition, he said he urged them to proceed as best they could. He wanted to go all the way. They didn't want to. And so what the Supreme Court has said, and it was two or three different cases, one of them quite clear, that if that procedure doesn't go forward to arbitration, then the employee is free to proceed under their contract claim. And that's what we're doing, and I think that's pretty clear. To address the actual issue, the one that Judge Sutterworth decided for Mr. Thomas, I think there's two things. First of all, they argue that the collective bargaining agreement doesn't incorporate the work rules. Well, the work rules themselves, as we've pointed out, this is the operator handbook, says this: the T's attendance control policy applies to all employees represented by Teamsters Local 997. This program supersedes all prior attendance control programs, is intended to be and should be, they say, constructed. I think the word probably should have been construed, but let's just use constructed, which they use here, in accordance with the collective bargaining agreement between McDonnell Transit, Inc., DBA, the T, and the Teamsters Local 997, effective October 1st, 2000 through September 30th, 2003, and any successor collective bargaining agreements. Well, that is the collective bargaining agreement that we're dealing with. And so they quite clearly say that policy is to be, I think, construed in accordance with the collective bargaining agreement and the collective bargaining agreement itself. The same Article 20 that they're citing for their one-year policy says, on page 17 of the agreement, work rules shall be published and copies provided to all employees. New work rules shall be posted immediately on the appropriate bulletin board or boards and copies provided to all effective employees as soon as possible. An up-to-date applicable rule book will be kept and maintained in the operator's room in the proximity of the maintenance department time clock. Employees shall be responsible for knowledge of the rules, so published or posted, and ignorance of such rules shall not be a reason for a claim that disciplinary action was without just cause. The two are clearly intended to be interpreted together. But if you and we clearly raise the question that this, to interpret it as they are, is contrary to the Family Medical Leave Act. And the Department of Labor agrees. And we've cited that 29 CFR section 825.220. It's tab 3, I believe, in our brief, and it says, quite frankly, FMLA prohibits the following: an employer is prohibited from discriminating against employees or prospective employees who have used FMLA leave. For example, if an employee on leave without pay would otherwise be entitled to full benefits other than health benefits, the same benefits would be required to be provided to an employee on unpaid FMLA leave. By the same token, employers cannot use the taking of FMLA leave as a negative factor in employment actions such as hiring, promotions, or disciplinary actions, nor can FMLA leave be counted under no-fault attendance policies. I mean, it's just a clear, once again, the CFR is an interpretation by the Department of Labor, but that's how they interpret their act, and I think the act's pretty clear that to do so, to penalize him in that way, would be contrary to the FMLA.
So your position would be, even if the employee handbook is unavailable or is inapplicable to the CBA agreement, the FMLA regs would still control?
Yes. In other words, that the interpretation of the contract has to be made consistent with the law, and the law is that you can't interpret it in the way the defendants are trying to interpret it. So, that's our position. One way or the other, I believe that he'd be entitled to it. There's no question. There might, if you look through the record, that they were questioning that for a while, but we've obtained those documents where they clearly say he was on FMLA leave until October such and such. And I'm not going to go into the other facts. We dispute very much whether he was eligible to go for rehire, et cetera. That was part of our other motion, but the court denied that, and it's no sense in going into it, but the fact of business is there was a long history of trying to go back to work, pass the DOT physical, et cetera, et cetera. But when the court ruled on this, because the remedy would be the same either way, that's when we entered into the stipulation relative to the entire case. So basically, just appealing this contract interpretation. So, number one, we feel like the contract was interpreted correctly. Number two, these matters were raised before the district court in these replies to their defensive pleading. And secondly, we argued then, as we did now, that the that for various reasons, one is just the inapplicability to this type of an action of the grievance procedure, but of the arbitration procedure, and the fact that they waived their own arbitration procedure. Plus, once again, you can do a legal look at it that way. In order for him to have waived his rights under the FMLA, they had to make that clear and concise in this document, in one of these documents, which they didn't do. And so I think either way, he's entitled to the benefit of the waiver document. I might also add that that on this, it wasn't raised before the trial court. As I understand the rule, and I believe they correctly cited the Cincinnati Life Insurance case versus Cates. Once again, while the court must rule on those arguments that are made, we're talking about, okay, we made a waiver argument. Whether the details of it were fleshed out or not is not really what the court's talking about. It's talking about whether you raised the issue, not whether you cited every case that was listed under it or whatever, et cetera. I don't think that's what it says. Plus, it also says, Cincinnati Life says, that however, Rule 166 does not prevent an appellate court from affirming the judgment on other grounds the parties properly raised before the trial court when the trial court grants summary judgment specifically on fewer than all grounds asserted. So, once again, I think those grounds were asserted. I think we did make those arguments, and that the interpretation that was given by Judge Sudreth was a correct one as a matter of law. If there's any other questions, I'll be glad to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brender. Mr. Tatum.
Briefly, I think the record does reflect what they responded to and what they didn't, and I don't believe they respond or they raised at least the waiver issue on behalf of the T. They contended in their response that they had not waived any rights under the CBA, but I don't think they contended that the T had. I'm looking for that issue right now, but I couldn't put my hands on it. A brief comment about the discussion of rule books in the CBA. The fact that they are included in there, that a mention of a rule book is included in there, doesn't mean that they are a part of the agreement. It just simply refers to that rule book as containing information that's relevant to the day-to-day operation of the company, but it does not, by mentioning a rule book, incorporate everything in the rule book as a contractual provision, particularly in light of the disclaimers.
What about the provision in the rule book saying it will be construed in accordance with the collective bargaining agreement? Does it say that?
It says that, and the response to that simply is, Your Honor, that there are two very clear distinctions in these two provisions, one in the operating manual and one in the CBA, that deal with different issues. I think they can be construed consistently. Because they deal with different issues, and they deal so that there's the clear absence of any other mitigating circumstances in the 12-month no-fault policy wasn't an accident. That was part of the bargaining agreement, and I think that if they had intended to include issues such as jury duty and the other types of issues that were included in the handbook, they would have. This was a collective bargaining agreement, not a unilateral document. The FMLA issue itself, again, is its own cause of action. That statute has its own series of remedies. A contention that the FMLA was violated, and quite frankly, there could be an argument that the union violated the FMLA by agreeing to the provision in the CBA that failed to include FMLA leave. But that is its own cause of action. And there are remedies provided in that document, including fees, reinstatement, you know, the full range of sort of employment-related remedies that one might seek in a situation like this. No claim was ever brought under the FMLA. And, you know, there was no, I don't know whether there was standing to bring it or not. I have no, that was not an issue that was addressed below, and it's not before us now, except that that statute does contain its own series of remedies should it be violated. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tatum. Thank you, Mr. Brender. Your case is submitted. We will go on to the next case, Trammell versus State of Texas.